Okay, I guess we'll begin. Our guest today is Dr. Paul Heyer. Paul has a PhD in anthropology from Rutgers University. And those of you who looked at his CV can review his series of awards there. He particularly is currently at work on a book which he will publish sometime, probably spring, summer, fall.
The book will be finished in a couple of weeks. Hopefully publish it in here.
And so our timing is particularly good in having Paul here now, since he has all the ideas for his book ready to go. And the title of his talk today, Marx and Darwin, A Related Legacy on Man, Nature, and Society, is also the title of the book and the title of the dissertation. Paul, with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. Rather than read a formal paper on a topic of interest to me, and perhaps only a few of you, I've decided to be somewhat more daring and experimental, a broad outline, or amounts to an aerial view or an abstract of the book that I'm currently completing, titled Marx and Darwin, A Related Legacy on Man, Nature, and Society. This work has been a substantial extension and revision of what was my PhD dissertation in anthropology completed several years ago at Rutgers University. As you may surmise, it's been a rather unorthodox dissertation to do in the Department of Anthropology. I believe that the work has significance to the history and theory of the social sciences, philosophy, history of sciences, and hopefully communication studies, and that this significance will be apparent as I unfold and arrange before you the various topics that I'm going to discuss in it. I also hope, because it is such an inclusive study, that no matter what the interest of each of you within communications, and so far I've got the impression that your field is as widely ranging as my own of anthropology pretends to be, that no matter what your particular interest, you may find in this work something of value, perhaps something relating to your own research. Naturally, all I can do in so brief a span of time is to give you an inkling of the scope of the project. I thought this would be the better course to follow, rather than take selected arguments and present them in some detail, to throw out the total conceptual entity and just see what happens. To save on words, I provided two supplements. On the board is an outline of the chapters in the order that they are going to appear in the book. Those marked with an asterisk, I'll say a few words about, and those without, I'll just mention in passing. In front of you, you have a chronological sketch, which will help you locate events in time, such as the publication dates of major works. It is far from complete. I realize there are gaps, but in regard to what I'm going to say, the things on there will be what's mentioned. The first chapter is titled Establishing Connections. In it, I give the rationale for the work as a whole, that it is to be theoretically comparative as opposed to biographical. It is biographical only as a means. And I preview the legitimacy of the comparison as it will be developed in subsequent chapters. For example, almost any discussion of great thinkers who profoundly influenced the course of history will invariably yield the names of Marx and Darwin, often in the same breath. One reason for this is the fact that they were contemporaries. Yet how contemporaneous they actually were is something most people are not aware of, and I myself didn't become aware of it until 2 years after I had started on the project and I drafted the sketch. And the relations are almost uncanny. They were born, underwent a developmental period, Darwin sailing around the world on the Beagle, engaged in those epoch-making observations which would culminate in the origin of species, and at more or less the same time, Marx is a student of philosophy at the University of Vienna. They wrote major works and they died at almost identical times. I've been unable so far to ascertain any astrological reasons for these connections, but I'm open to any possibility. Also, Marx and Darwin dominated their age in a way that perhaps no two other minds ever have, and I think there's good argument for giving them joint ownership of the second half of the 19th century. Now, these parallels can be accepted without too much question. It is when we go beyond the facts of their historical existence to a discussion and interpretation of theoretical ideas that controversy surfaces. In a very deliberate way, my work is a response to three traditions that I believe have been crucial in determining the current reception accorded the Marx-Darwin relationship. The first tradition is the Marxist-Leninist view. They have assumed that the theory and method of Marx and Darwin were one and the same, that they were joint partners in revealing the inexorable laws of history in the case of Marx and evolution in the case of Darwin, and brothers in developing that matter-before-mind materialist philosophy in the 19th century that served to upend the notions of traditional theology. So they, by and large, accept the Marx-Darwin link as dogma. It isn't explored in any analytical depth, it's just assumed to be so. The second tradition I have difficulty labeling, and for want of an accurate rubric, I'll call it the philosophical Marxists, or the recent philosophical Marxists. This includes several people of diverse intellectual persuasion who are linked in the fact that they believe in disavowing the connection between Marx and the natural sciences, and thereby disavowing the link with Darwin, and they stress the early philosophical aspects of Marx and Hegelian influences on his thought. Now, I contend that these are valid enterprises, very worthy, but one can emphasize them without having to deny these other aspects of Marx. And in this camp, as I said, are diverse thinkers. They include the Frankfurt School of Critical Theorists, Marcuse and company, the existentialist Marxists following from Sartre, and several recent historians and critics of Marx, such as David McCollum and Shlomo Avineri. The third tradition that I'm applying to in my work is the tradition of 20th century social science, who by and large ignored completely the Marx-Darwin possibility. They've accepted Darwin as a figure of significance in biology, but assumed that any social or human applications of his theory was tantamount to doing social Darwinism. They've taken certain aspects of Marx, true, but aspects which tend to mesh with already acceptable models, and the social sciences, by and large, have not assessed Marx in his entirety in this century. And although two of these traditions that I've just mentioned deal with the Marx-Darwin issue, there is still no sustained, comparative, critical study of the two men, and it is into this void that I plunge with this work. Still in the first chapter, I go on to point out the similarity in the range of thought expressed by the two men. Both dealt with the nature of man, the nature of society, and the importance of primitive societies in understanding the earlier phases of human history and the human potential. Both Marx, coming out of philosophy, and Darwin, coming from the biology of his day, sought in their own way a unified approach to the study of man, a problem-oriented perspective capable of linking the social and the natural sciences with the humanities. This is not to suggest that they were engaged in precisely parallel enterprises. Rather, my argument is aimed at demonstrating a complementarity in their respective visions. I also try to demonstrate the concern which each thinker had with what is usually thought of as being the other's field of expertise, and I find this personally fascinating. Marx, both formally and on his own, studied the natural sciences of the 19th century with a passion. And Darwin, usually thought of as merely an empirical scientist, delved into philosophy and problems relating to the nature of man. These were confined to his notebooks, unpublished during his own lifetime, but recently published, and they are very fascinating. Although Marx has been accepted as a multifaceted intellectual figure, at universities where I've studied, there have been courses on Marx in history, economics, political science, anthropology, and sociology, and probably a few others. Darwin has been perceived in a much more limited way, and this has served to belie the significance of his contribution. One biographer of Darwin, Jacques Barzin, has called him a master fact-gatherer, a Hegelian world historical character rather than a truly creative thinker. That is, that he is someone who is doing the right thing at the right time and whose methodical, plodding approach succeeds in creating a tremendous intellectual breakthrough. However, the tide of opinion regarding Darwin is shifting, and there has been, over the last few years, what I call in my work a Darwin Renaissance, and two works have been crucial in this. One is a book by Michael T. Gislin called The Triumph of the Darwinian Method, and in it he shows that Darwin's understanding of theory was extremely sophisticated, and the whole development of the theory of evolution came about through Darwin's sophisticated understanding of theory rather than from a simple marshalling of facts. The second book by Howard Gruber and Paul Barrett is called Darwin on Man, and they look at Darwin's contributions from the point of view of the creative process, how this was central to Darwin's ideas. They also look at Darwin on Man, particularly his unpublished notebooks. I think it is very significant that the book by Gruber and Barrett has a preface in it by Jean Piaget. I then go on to illustrate the links that Marx had with natural sciences, and this is not a fashionable position to take in the West at present. And two anecdotes, I think, will help to illustrate this. At his graveside, Engels said, just as Darwin discovered the law of evolution in organic nature, so Marx discovered the law of evolution in human history. I think that if this comparison did not hold meaning for Marx, Engels would not have elected to bring it up at such a sensitive moment. In the same brief graveside speech, Engels also mentioned, sees fit to mention, the fascination which Marx had with the natural sciences of his day. Again, if this did not hold significance to Marx, I do not see why Engels would mention it. Despite this incident, several prominent Marxist scholars have taken pains to deny the validity of this comparison. Another little anecdote, which is interesting, occurred in a popular Victorian parlor game, which Marx played with one of his daughters. In this game, one is asked to name one's favorite flower, one's favorite color, one's favorite motto, and so on. When Marx was asked to name his favorite hero, he decided to give two names, Spartacus and Kepler, and I think this is very indicative of the way Marx perceived himself. Spartacus, the political revolutionary, the man of action, certainly Marx saw himself in this light. But Kepler, a thinker, a genius of pure science, I think Marx saw himself in this light as well. That his thinker would be Kepler, as opposed to, say, Hegel or Aristotle, indicates the high regard he had for the natural sciences or pure theoretical science. If Darwin had not been a living, breathing influence, it's possible that he might have got the nomination. Throughout his life, Marx systematically studied the natural sciences, and I give extensive documentation for this. Although his friend and collaborator Engels is well known for having written about science, and you can see from the sketch the dialectics of nature in the 1870s, most people are unaware that Marx too wrote on scientific matters. And in the 1870s, he drafted about 900 pages of mathematical manuscript, which today are accessible only in Russian. Well, I couldn't read Russian, but there's one article which translates portions of it. They contain abstracts of texts and essays on selected problems and illustrate the tremendous insight he had into this field. I've made the supposition to several biologists, and they seem to be much in agreement, that Marx saw in Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection the mathematical precision that 20th century evolution has since developed. But ironically enough, although Marx and Engels were good and interested in mathematics, Darwin had no proclivity at all for mathematics. It was one of his worst subjects, despite the fact that his work had mathematical implications to it. Also, Darwin's was terrible in languages, a field which Marx and Engels both excelled. So this is one aspect of differences between them. I then go on to document the Marx-Darwin correspondence, which took place between 1870 and 1880. In particular, the instance where Marx is alleged to have wanted to dedicate Das Kapital to Darwin. What happened was Marx sent excerpts from what we believe was the forthcoming English edition of Capital to Darwin in 1880, along with a letter. The letter has not survived, and neither have the excerpts. The only way we know about this incident is because Darwin wrote a letter to Marx which has survived. In this letter to Marx, Darwin politely declines a dedication, and again, we assume it's the first English edition of Capital. It could be the second volume of the German edition, I'm not sure, and nobody else is there present. Darwin is afraid of affiliating himself with so atheistic an argument as that presented by Marx, and he cites reasons of ill health and the pain it might cause his family. But he closes the letter with an affirmation to the effect that he believes that both Marx and himself are working in towards the furtherance of human knowledge in similar directions. Oh, by the way, it was Darwin's heirs that destroyed the correspondences, so we don't have anything left on the Darwin end. We only have the Marx end of it. The remainder of the first chapter, I look at several pretty obscure socialist writers who, at the turn of the century, tried to link the perspectives of Marx and Darwin. This was largely in opposition to the appropriation of Darwin by the so-called social Darwinists, the laissez-faire capitalist individualist school of struggle for survival. And they saw in Marx a compatibility which existed with Darwin and wrote some obscure works in that area. I then deal with what I call the bleakest aspect in the history of the relations between Marx and Darwin. And this occurred in the Soviet Union. Lenin began the trend with his particular interpretation of Marx, but the situation reached a peak under Stalin when Lysenko, T.D. Lysenko, took over the Academy of Sciences in Russia, abolished genetics, and purged the academy of anyone who was not a believer in the inheritance of acquired characteristics or a stimulus response model for psychology. This Soviet interpretation, the reason I bring this up in the work, the Soviet interpretation of Marx, is because it has been referred to as either Soviet Darwinism or Marxian biology, and I think these are gross misnomers. Now, this Soviet interpretation has been largely responsible for the endeavor on the part of recent Western scholars of Marx the ones that I mentioned earlier, to sever him from all affiliation with any natural science tradition. They are, in a sense, overreacting to the Soviet distortion and interpretation of Marx, the subordination of science to politics that occurred there. Finally, I wind up the first chapter by stating that Marx's views on human nature and society can be connected to a natural science perspective. He was insistent on this both in his early and his later writings, and that doing such does not imply Leninism, Stalinism, or Lysenkoism. And looking at the full implications in terms of man and society of Garland's writings is not tantamount to doing classical social Darwinism. The second chapter, titled Evolution and History, is currently awaiting completion. It's in a state of chaotic disarray as far as notes and observations are concerned. In it, I intend to show the common intellectual antecedents to the respective views of Darwin on evolution and Marx on history. This will include their similar acceptance of uniformitarian geology, that is, that the Earth has a history written in everyday processes going on, such as erosion and deposition. It is well known that the work of Lyell in geology influenced Darwin, but Marx too was fascinated by this and saw a connection between the history of the Earth preferred by geology and his own materialist conception of history, the history of man. They also had a very dissimilar assessment of the contributions of the political economist Thomas Malthus, and I analyzed the reasons for these differences. I will then comparatively examine and hopefully provide a solid general introduction to the theory of evolution by natural selection, Darwin's major contribution, and the materialist conception of history of Marx. This will include an analysis of the similarities and differences in their respective methods. It would also include a discussion of materialism as a philosophical worldview and the way it is similar in both Marx and Darwin. Although Marx is well known for being an outspoken materialist, Darwin too is a materialist, but he expressed this not in public form, but in his notebooks. He referred to his own view as a materialist. The third chapter, Nature and Flux, Hegel, is pretty much for aficionados of philosophy. I look at Hegel's philosophy of nature, the way it did and did not influence Marx, the concept of evolution in Hegel, and how it compares to the formulations of Darwin and a number of other evolutionary thinkers such as Spencer. In the next two chapters, I take a comparative look at notions regarding human nature expressed by Marx and Darwin. Marx came to the problem early in the philosophical writings of the 1840s, and the vision of man contained in these writings continued to underwrite his later political and economic studies, though not in an open and an obvious way. One has to, in a sense, read between the lines, but there is continuity in Marx between the early and later Marx, and I am emphasizing this in my work. The influence of two major philosophical precursors on Marx is noted, and they are Hegel, from whom Marx derived a sense of process and history, and Feuerbach, from whom Marx derived a sense of the organic or sensuous nature of man. Feuerbach did not deal with history, and Marx criticized him for this in the famous thesis on Feuerbach, and Hegel did not deal with man in his organic sensuous state. And Marx criticized Hegel for this, and in a way took the best of the two philosophers into his own approach. I then go on to frame a threefold scheme in the chapter, which I think Marx's views can be profitably scrutinized, his views of human nature as a whole. And these three categories are, one, Marx establishes in his writings about human nature and man, continuity between man and nature. Man is affirmed as being a part of nature to counter the rift opened up between them by two sources. One, the traditional idealist aspects of philosophy, beginning with Descartes, Kant, and Hegel. And two, he affirms the link between man and nature to counter the rift opened up between them by the theology of his day. Secondly, Marx sees man as possessing a network of species characteristics, which distinguish man from the rest of creation. Nevertheless, these species characteristics are said to have an organic basis. And in his early writings, Marx gives a whole series of traits which he concludes are definitive of man. He calls them species life, species powers, species tendencies, and so on. And a modern biologist would call this a kind of species-specific definition of man. The third category that I find it useful to group Marx's observations on human nature is that he takes the natural human capacities, the various species traits, and sees them as interacting with external nature through labor, and labor is a key concept in Marx, which I get into. And through this interaction is produced the constantly changing social and ideological situations in which man defines himself and his human nature. In another sense, we can call it culture, although Marx doesn't use the phrase in this context. In this, Marx sees man as a culture-building, tool-making animal. Although these ideas on man put forth by Marx are for the most part pre-Darwinian, they were most fully elaborated in the early writings, the writings of the 1840s. They are very biological in orientation and highly compatible with the later Darwinian perspective. For example, both Marx and Darwin saw man as a part of nature. What Darwin did in his later work was to show how man came out of nature. Well, in 1844 and 1845, Marx did not have the scientific wherewithal to show how man came out of nature, but he was very insistent that man is a part of nature and kept defining these characteristics of man as if they were naturally given. And this caused me to pick up a phrase from Feuerbach, which I thought was very apropos to apply to the early Marx and his organically grounded view of the nature of man. And I don't know whether Marx was aware of this or not, but Feuerbach once said, from whence does man come? First ask, what is man? Once his essence is clear to you, you will also know his origin. And I think that is very apropos to the early Marx, where he's dealing with the essence of man, not yet having the scientific wherewithal to deal with the origins of man, which is a task Darwin undertook in the 1870s. Also, and this argument is, I think, very important, Marx did not view man as an infinitely malleable creature. I agree 100% with Eric Fromm when he states that Marx was not a sociological relativist. He believed in a concept of human nature biologically or psychologically. Marx talks about man's natural powers of life, his tendencies, abilities, instincts. There is a kind of concept of human nature, of the way man is predisposed in Marx, that I don't think lends itself to a totally behaviorist view where the environment is completely determinant and the human capacities do not enter into the equation. Before moving on to Darwin, let me throw out a few interesting ideas that fit in several of these headings that Marx had regarding human nature. In the work, which is the first full statement of the materialist conception of history, and that is the German ideology written in 1845 and 1846, Marx stated that the first task of history is to understand the physical and psychological organization of man and his relationship to the rest of nature. This is a fundamental tenet, an opening statement as to how history should approach. First, we must deal with man as an organic entity. Although physically and psychologically, Marx regarded man as an animal, and he's very fond of referring to man as an animal, and I think this is to take a swipe at the theology of his day as well as idealist philosophy. Marx held that man had added characteristics which give him an extra step on the rest of nature, self-consciousness being one of them. While other animals tend to be at one with their life activity, man can see it from a distance. He can act back on it, or in the modern phenomenological sense, we can say that he's conscious of his intentionality. Through labor, man mediates between nature, his natural needs, and his human distinctiveness. And in this sense, Marx kind of anticipates the approach of Levi-Strauss by viewing man as affecting, through labor, the transformation from nature to culture. Marx sees labor as a primary natural human force. He calls it the everlasting naturally imposed condition of human existence and says it is independent of every historical phase of that existence, or rather is common to every such phase. Therefore it is trans-historical, trans-cultural, pan-cultural, or whatever you want to call it. It is a universal endowment, an innate tendency, if you will. One of the principal ways that man through labor shapes his historical development is through the use of tools. Marx, in Capital, subscribes to Benjamin Franklin's definition of man as a tool-making animal. Marx sees tools as fabrications of the human will as it seeks to appropriate from nature. His definition of tools is, I think, unsurpassed, even in light of contemporary anthropological interest in the problem. He calls, and I find this phrase just gorgeous, tools are origins of the human hand created by the human brain, the power of knowledge objectified. And I've never been able to find a better definition than that. Marx's concern with tools and their effect on human arrangements extends from the earliest stone axes that were used in primitive society and prehistory and their role in the organization of labor right up to the technology of the 19th century, including such things as the telegraph and the locomotive. Marx was concerned with the social and, to some extent in the theory of alienation, the psychic consequences of these fabrications. And despite what McLuhan says, and I think he puts it to the effect that Karl Marx missed the communications boat because Karl Marx failed to deal with various technological aspects of communications and their consequences, this is totally untrue. And I think there is a lot of McLuhan anticipated in Marx that I imagine McLuhan has totally ignored or chose to overlook. Shifting to what is probably the most fundamental mode of communication in man, language, Marx calls it practical consciousness, again, a philosophical term. He claims that it mediates between individual thoughts and feelings and the necessity for social existence. Since it is produced by man, it must be a human product. It is not external, totally external to man. It is something that man creates with his natural human capacity. And it is created through need and interaction, a very Darwinian kind of notion. But it continually develops or evolves and acts back on its creator, giving him an understanding and definition of his existence. In the chapter Human Nature, Darwin's Giant Leap, I show that in contrast to Marx, who came to the subject of human nature early and did extended discussions of it in the writings of the 1840s, Darwin came to it late in life. And this was primarily in The Descent of Man in 1871, you can see it on the chronology, and The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animal, the 1872 work. Prior to the publication of these works, it must be mentioned, Darwin was continually crucified for the alleged man-ape kinship that he expressed in The Origin of Species. Well, the fact of the matter is that Darwin never discussed the evolution of man in The Origin of Species. He is crucified for the implications of what he said, what he was purported to have said, not for what he actually did say. When Darwin did eventually write about man, and it was a courageous effort on his part, we have to remember that he was a very withdrawn personality, shunned controversy at every turn, and was sick. He had a disease that he picked up while traveling around the world in the Beagle. And it would seem, from looking at his memoirs, the last thing he would do was enter into a really ripe controversy by writing about man. Yet somehow he felt it necessary to advance human knowledge at that point in time, and he engaged in the writing of The Descent of Man and the Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals. Part of the reason for him deciding to write these works is that he had been keeping elaborate notes all his life on man, and I think these must have put pressure on him to actually come out and make public statements on them. What is really interesting is when Darwin did write about man, did make these statements public, the work caused barely a ripple. It was almost unnoticed. Apparently, I think his critics were played out. They had attacked him for his alleged position for so many years, and very often looked ridiculous in so doing, that when Darwin did finally say what everybody thought he had said, the critics were too exhausted or played out to respond. Unfortunately, his defenders seem to have been played out too, because, as I said, the work caused little controversy and didn't receive praise. On the other hand, it was virtually unnoticed. It was published only in a limited edition. But I think it's a major testament to Darwin's genius. I think there were three great biological problems to be solved in the 19th century, and Darwin tried to solve all three, and he succeeded in solving two. The first great problem to be solved was generating a plausible theory and a mechanism for evolution, not merely affirming it as a law of nature, the way people like Lamarck and Spencer and Robert Chambers had done prior to Darwin, but actually giving forth a method that could be empirically bolstered. And Darwin made this contribution in 1859 with the publication of The Origin of Species. The second great biological problem to be solved in the 19th century was assessing man's place both physically and psychologically and socially in the natural scheme of things. Marx began doing this in the 1840s without scientific knowledge or sophistication, although he continually hoped that science would add to what he was doing. Darwin tried it using his own evolutionary method and set the precedent for future research in the area of human evolution. So this is a kind of twofold major contribution. He gave us evolution, and he gave us the evolution of man. And the one does not necessarily follow the other. It's a tribute to Darwin's creative labor that he was able to do the two. The third great biological problem to be solved, Darwin tried and he failed, and that was generating a mechanism of inheritance. This was done in 1865 by the Moravian monk Gregor Mendel, from whom we have gotten Mendelian genetics. And what is very interesting is that at one point, Darwin had Mendel's article in his hand. He was actually looking at it, but he couldn't figure out what was going on, and never became receptive to Mendel's ideas. But this is not so much a criticism of Darwin, because nobody else in the 19th century fathomed Mendel either, and he died virtually unknown. It wasn't until the turn of the century that the rediscovery of Mendelian genetics took place. Well, Darwin wasn't Mendelian. He had his own strange concepts of inheritance, which do not stand the test of time. But it is a tribute to his diligence that he tried to solve this problem, even though he did not have the insight to be successful in it. In the two books on man, Darwin tried to establish, with his evolutionary method as a name, man's kinship to the rest of creation. Once again, the same thing that Marx tried to do in the 1840s. In The Descent, Darwin tries to show that man is derived from some pre-existing form. He points out the physical resemblances between man and other animals in a very systematic, thorough, and careful way. Yet, this was not such a heretical position to take at that time, because a lot of taxonomically oriented natural scientists were saying the same, that man somehow structurally was related to the rest of nature. The real heresy in Darwin's writings on man, The Descent of Man and the Expression of the Emotions, was in proclaiming that links deriving from descent existing between man and other animals in terms of mind and behavior. And this is heretical today, even in the social sciences. He sought to show that in his various behaviors, such as facial expressions and his social capacities and moral sentiments, man showed similarity to behaviors exhibited in other animals. Darwin saw an instinctive residue in man lying at the root of these behaviors. This is not to imply that he denied human uniqueness. He thought that the defining characteristic of man was reason, but not reason in an either-or situation. Man possessed reason in greater abundance than any animals, and therefore he could be seen as a reasoning animal. In a sense, Darwin was taking man from his exalted perch and bringing him closer to nature and natural processes. He was, as some people have said, I don't think it's true, demeaning man by so doing. But he was also engaged in a parallel enterprise where he was taking the animal, hitherto thought to be governed by blind instinct, being a hydraulic machine, and elevating them to a level where Darwin said that reason exists in animals in a rudimentary way. It can be found, for example, in behaviors of chimpanzees. Well, recent research, as some of you may know, in the area of ethology, has shown that we now have to have a high respect for the intelligence of chimps. They exhibit the syntactic behavior in their everyday lives. That is, an increasing independence of conceptual activity from the sensory environment. In Darwin's sense, we can say they exhibit, in a rudimentary state, reason. And Darwin's main argument was that it's a matter of degree. Man was the reasoning animal. He possessed reasoning in greater abundance than any of the other animals, but it was not an either-or situation, where man was only a creature of reason, had no vestigial instincts, and animals had no reason at all, and were totally discovered. Governed by blind instinct. The main argument for an instinctive infrastructure, if you will, to human behavior is made by Darwin in The Expression of the Emotions in the Man and Animals, a work which is an extension of the argument that he put forth in The Descent of Man. This work is a pioneering study in the study of nonverbal communication, both in a cross-cultural sense and looking at comparative expressive behavior in other animals. Darwin looks at a whole range of behaviors, such as anger, fear, affection, pleasure in man and animals, and how they are communicated to members of the same species. And looking at nonverbal behavior in the expression, Darwin's methods show considerable insight, and they anticipate a lot of research which is being done today in that area. And let me give you a partial list of some of the ways that Darwin approached the problem. He studied play behavior in children. He studied interactions among the insane. He observed his own baby's development. He analyzed expressive behavior that he saw in various works of art. He read anthropological accounts with an eye to looking at the aspects of nonverbal communication and how similar or different they were in various cultures. And this one I find particularly interesting. He took photographs of various expressive behaviors and showed them to informants and asked for responses. What kind of message was being communicated by this facial expression or this hand gesture? And I think this is very interesting because people are doing that today. And finally, he composed an elaborate questionnaire asking how various attitudes were expressed in terms of communication in different cultures. I think he sent 200 or so of these questionnaires to far-flung locales, to missionaries, and to various outposts, and got a good number of them back. And his conclusions on this were that there was such a similarity in the range of expression of behavior in man in all these cultures that this leads him to believe that man is one species, or in the modern biological sense, we can say that man is one polytypic species. And Darwin thought the fact that the communication of various behaviors was so similar in so many races affirmed what anthropologists call the psychic unity of the human species. Now, about 100 years later, a similar experiment was undertaken in a somewhat different way. Some of you who are interested in the area of nonverbal communication may know about the work of Ivo Eibelsfeld, the ethologist. Well, he went around the world, covered many areas that Darwin covered, but he did it with a camera rather than a questionnaire. And it was a trick camera where the lens, which was really taking the film, came out the side, not the front, so he could catch people unaware, so to speak. And he did analysis of expressive behaviors in a number of diverse cultures, and he too came to the conclusion that the range of expression is so similar that mankind cannot be but one species. And the name of that book is Ethology, the Biology of Behavior, in which Ivo Eibelsfeld outlines this particular plan. In the two chapters on the social as natural, I extend the Marx-Darwin discussion on human nature into the realm of society, because they both believe that society is somehow an extension or an essential expression of human nature. It is not something apart, impinging on man and constraining his behavior, which is the view that sociology has appropriated from Durkheim. Both men cite Aristotle's famous statement that man is, quote, a social animal. I then go on to focus on Marx's ideas on the organic basis of society, ideas that have not penetrated into the subsequent social sciences. This is an aspect of Marx's writing which is, by and large, been overlooked. Marx held, and it is fully elaborated in the early writings of the 1840s, as well as a recurring theme in later writings such as Das Kapital, that society is generic to and synonymous with being human, that it is a natural legacy resulting from, one, the production and maintenance of life through labor, what he sees as being a human universal, and the generation of fresh life through procreation, a very earthy kind of Darwinian assumption, despite the fact that he made it in 1845. He also goes on to link society or social behavior in man with what he calls the gregarious herd propensity found in other animals, once again in 1845, and a remarkable anticipation of the kind of work that Darwin was going to do. I then go on to scrutinize the concept of the social organs in Marx outlined in the Paris manuscripts. That is, that the social somehow affects, permeates every facet of human existence and experience. This is followed by an examination of the importance of exchange in Marx's writing. He held exchange to be the distinctive trait of human sociability. He called it the social species act, or the social metabolic process. His analysis of exchange behavior ranges from the basic cooperation of individuals in the division of labor to a complex study of the flow of commodities between various sectors of the capitalist society expressed in terms of a baffling economic algebra. Volume 2 of Capital is just a mind blower. I then go on to dichotomize Marx's vision of society into what I term primary and subsequent social relations. That is, I think it's useful to group his observations into these two categories. The primary social relations are those that result from the bonds which link human beings together at the interpersonal level. They are such things as the family and kin and extended kin groupings. Tribal societies are an example where the social organization of society conforms to what I call the primary social relationships. What Marx would say is that in these societies, social and natural relationships are in harmonious balance. They are homologous, if you will. The subsequent social relations include such things as civil society, feudalism, and the state. They derive from the exchange of labor and commodities between groups rather than between individuals. I then go on to look at Marx's concept of the state, how he regarded the state as a natural outgrowth of society at a particular period in its development, yet somehow it wasn't an authentic expression of the true potential of human nature. And they go on to deal with this. Darwin also held the social to be natural, and using his evolutionary method, he sought to show why it is the way it is and how it got to be that way in the first place. Again, this is to be found in the later works, The Descent of Man and the Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals. He looked comparatively at sociability in man and other animals, particularly those closest to the human line, such as the primates. He showed that nature is not typified by the so-called life and death struggle between individuals, but possesses also a good deal of cooperative behavior between individuals of the same species. He talked about the evolutionary advantages of moral sentiments and reason, which he held to be part of the social package. In stark contrast to the social Darwinists, who emphasized struggle for existence and individual aggressive assertiveness, the social Darwinists in that allegedly Darwin spawned, it was quite a far removed from what Darwin was really all about. In The Descent of Man, there are a number of postulates expressed which are completely antithetical to everything the social Darwinists were talking about. Darwin was aware of what some of them were doing, but didn't want controversy, so he never came out publicly to criticize them or address himself to this problem. Darwin favored legislation to help those less fortunate, and this is a quote from The Descent. "We cannot check our sympathy without deterioration of the noblest part of our nature." He believed that sociability, moral sentiments, the cooperative capacity were part of man's natural endowment. And that is a far cry from the way many people have perceived him as being a life and death individualist struggle for survival. Darwin's ideas on the social, a lot of them that I haven't mentioned here, are admittedly speculative. And he was the first to acknowledge that he was dealing with speculation, albeit speculation derived from his theory. I think it is to pay him the highest tribute to say that the method which he gave us, the theory of evolution by natural selection, can help to disprove some of the speculations which he put forth regarding the nature of society. The last part of that chapter, I go on to deal with three thinkers during the 19th century who I find fascinating because each in their own way worked with the concept of the social as natural, that in some ways were similar to the view of Marx and Darwin, and in some ways were different. And the first of these three thinkers is rather obscure to the social sciences, I imagine, is the British idealist philosopher F.H. Bradley, who was influenced by Kant, Hegel, and lo and behold, Darwin at that time, and put forth a view of society which reflected these influences, and I'm going to give a brief analysis and criticism of Bradley's view. The second thinker during that period to champion the view that the social was natural was the social philosopher or sociologist Fernand Tunnies in his work Community and Society. He believed that the social capacity was an aspect of human nature. But although he lived at a time when he could have derived inspiration and information from Darwin on this, I think the work came out in 1880, sometime in the 1880s, Tunnies' ideas didn't really owe their origin to the biology of his day, but rather were a kind of sophisticated survival of the Romantic Rebellion, and therefore very difficult to use as a platform for further research into the nature of society within the social sciences. But nonetheless, he echoed many of Darwin's views. Not echoed, the views were similar, but the source was different. The source was in a Romantic tradition rather than in the scientific tradition of the 19th century. The third thinker, who right at the close of the 19th century championed the view that the social was natural, was the Russian anarchist prince Peter Kropotkin, who wrote a very interesting book called Mutual Aid, in which he extended Darwin's argument on cooperation in the animal world greatly. He looked at cooperative behavior in animals all around the world, and he traveled widely, and a lot of this was based on first-hand observations, and he looked at various forms of cooperative behavior that were going on in various communes at the time. And although he was in London at the same time that Marx was in London, I've never seen a reference to Marx in Kropotkin. Kropotkin was mainly taken up with Darwin and anarchism. I think he would have viewed Marx's communism or socialism as a bit repellent to his nature. Lastly, I wind up the chapter by discussing the view regarding the nature of society that has been most influential to the social sciences during this century, and that is the view put forth by Emil Durkheim. I deal with its basic assumptions and show how it differs significantly from the views of Marx and Darwin. Moving on to the chapter on primitive society, slavery, and race, Marx and Darwin here demonstrated not only similar interests, but similar political convictions. In Darwin's case, a knowledge of primitive peoples derived from first-hand experiences. When Darwin sailed around the world on the Beagle in the 1830s and became involved in those epoch-making observations that came out in The Origin of Species, not only did he observe flora, fauna, and geology, but often the Beagle would touch upon areas where there were native groups who had never seen a white man, a ship, or even a gun, and Darwin observed them, at first from a distance, and then he got a chance to have contact with a few informants on the Beagle. Well, his ethnography, which is an anthropological term meaning a description of a culture, usually non-Western, isn't commensurate with his abilities as a naturalist. It is not shoddy, but lacks perception, let's say. Although it is better than many of the accounts of the day put forth by travelers and missionaries, Darwin's sensibilities were repelled by the behaviors of these people. Yet somehow he was sympathetic to them. He recognized them as being human, and I'll develop this in a minute. The Voyage of the Beagle, a work published in 1845, dealt with this ethnography. Darwin not only describes nature in a kind of literary way, he also describes his experiences upon encountering native groups. Marx, not having had first-hand experiences with primitive peoples the way Darwin did, nevertheless took a great interest in them. And I think three reasons can be given for this. One, he believed that history could not be fully comprehended until we understood something about prehistory, and he believed that primitive societies can somehow tell us something about that prehistoric stage of social existence where man spent perhaps 99% of his existence. Secondly, Marx was also responding to the great proliferation in the anthropological accounts of his day. From about 1850 on, a great many writers were dealing with ethnography and comparative sociology and compiling information on a lot of non-Western cultures. And Marx followed the development of these writings in the same way that he assiduously followed the development of the writings in the theoretical sciences at the same time. He was on top of the action, so to speak, in his day, and the action was coming in science and also in anthropology. Thirdly, he believed that somehow in primitive societies, natural and social relations were one and the same, that in these areas, mental and physical labor were in far greater harmony than they were subsequently in civilization. And primitive society became a model for him to elaborate the human possibility. His communist society of the future is in many respects a projection of the kinds of things that he thought were essential to primitive society. Now, vivid evidence for Marx's keen interest in anthropological and ethnographic accounts can be found in a book which has come out fairly recently, called The Ethnological Notebooks of Karl Marx, and this is edited by Lawrence Crater. Marx excerpts and critically scrutinizes the work of Morgan, Fear, Main, Lubbock, and a number of others who were writing at that time. Not only does he compile this information for future reference, what I found amazing when glancing through these notebooks is that he's very critical. There's a passage in there which I found to be a sheer delight. Lubbock is making an observation on a custom in some society, and I forget which society. He says, in such and such society, one married one sister, and it is abominable, meaning classificatory sister, a kin term sister. And then Marx, in a note in his notebooks, in bold letters, said, in such and such a society, one married one sister, then underlined, but in that society it was moral. So Marx is illustrating what is called a non-ethnocentric attitude. He is critically looking at this material and capable of saying something about it. Getting back to Darwin for a moment, in the ethnographic writings, which is the way I refer to the Voyage of the Beagle, he revealed strong political convictions regarding slavery and racial genocide, and this is apparent throughout the work. He documented instances of abuse to slaves at a number of occasions, and said they were atrocities unbefitting a civilized nation. He also carefully assessed the situation regarding racial genocide, which was going on in South America at that time in a very extensive way. And he indicted this very forcefully. And in this area, Darwin was really putting himself in line politically. He was very outspoken in this particular work, although it may have fallen on deaf ears. Later, he would support the American Civil, the North in the American Civil War with a passion equal to that of Marx. Now, I think one incident which I'd like to bring up that illustrates the strength of Darwin's political convictions regarding slavery occurred when the Beagle stopped at a plantation in Brazil. The captain of the ship, Fitzroy, was a pro-slaver and a fundamentalist, and throughout the voyage was trying to convince Darwin that slavery was the way things ought to be. So he took him to a plantation in Brazil and had the owner assemble all the slaves and ask the slaves if they wished to be free. And all the slaves replied, no, we do not wish to be free. And then Darwin turned to Fitzroy and said, the slave's answer in the presence of his master isn't worth too much. Well, Fitzroy became furious. He threw Darwin out of his cabin, and it looked like the young naturalist was going to be chucked off at the next port of call, and history might not have been the same since. Fortunately, a couple of days later, Fitzroy cooled down somewhat and apologized. But the fact that Darwin would make this proclamation at that time illustrates the strong convictions he had regarding slavery. A similar incident occurred, not with Fitzroy, but with someone else later in the voyage, where they said, look, see these slaves, how happy they are? And Darwin replied, these are household slaves from prosperous masters. He said, why don't you go down and look at the field slaves over yonder, and you'll find the situation isn't so delightful. So he really illustrated his political convictions on this issue. Now, Darwin's ethnographic experiences, despite the fact that savages made him indignant, he was horrified at the behavior of the Fuegians, somehow he affirmed that they were human. Through the repelled sensibility, he thought they were fully human. And this led...
That's been married.
Pardon?
I've been asking the question of Mr. Tony. I don't understand why he keeps saying that, that it was so wonderful, he thought they were human, and yet many people thought that.
In spite of... I find it curious.
Even the way that thing is posed to the current society, always a piece of surprise that he thought.
No, because he is making a description of them, which he says, miserable existence, and a whole bunch of terms which you would say, this guy must regard them as being something akin to animal. He's expressing personal sentiment. But then he goes as a scientist to affirm a common humanity. To justify an exploitative situation in the 19th century, I think racist is more apropos. So I think a different label racist is nearer to the 19th century than it is today.
But what do you see as the implications of people working within a particular society with that overall structure?
Well, the attitudes of Marx and Darwin, and the attitudes are the same, they both believe in the inheritance of acquired characteristics. They both thought that the darker-skinned peoples were raw, authentic humanity, capable in a generation or two of advancing to the higher levels. So they did not justify the exploitation of these people. They thought rather, well, since they are human, albeit in an uncultivated state, they are fully capable of being cultivated, and we shouldn't exploit them, but we should attempt to educate them. It may have been a paternalistic attitude, but that was the 19th century. And I'm kind of tolerant of this. I am intolerant of the social dogmas who said, okay, these racial differences are there, but they're absolutely unchangeable, and they justify the exploitation and enslavement of these people. So in the context of the 19th century, although by our standards today we might call Marx and Darwin a racist, I think it's unfair to use that label in the 19th century when they are actually the radical left on that position at that time. And you have to look at the situation in context.
Okay, then isn't there a problem that in looking upon these people as capable of being educated and brought to where we are, that we've got us here and then down here, and some kind of developmental model of civilization and so forth, doesn't that give you any kind of...
Oh yeah, they were 19th century men, both of them, sure. They believed in a hierarchical concept where Western civilization was at the peak of human evolution. There's no doubt that both men believed this. They weren't cultural relativists by any stretch of the imagination. But they went beyond others of this time in believing that these differences were modifiable over a generation or two, and that these darker-skinned peoples were fully human, just not quite yet up to the European standard. So they weren't apologists for imperialism, they were critics of imperialism, although racist critics of imperialism, if you will, in their own way.
So would you say that it's unjustifiable for feminists to criticize Freud for being a sexist, or to look at his work in terms of sexism and to apply them?
No, not at all. You can take Freud and apply it in a feminist perspective.
No, I'm talking about the criticism of Freud by feminists.
Sure, you can link Freud to the paternalistic attitudes of Vienna at that particular point. But then you have to assess, if you're going to parallel what I've just talked about, at that time, was Freud anti-feminist regarding the culture at large? And I'm saying that Marx and Darwin were more pro-egalitarian, anti-racist regards the culture at large. And in Freud's case, I think he is more parallel to the culture at large regarding the situation of women. So we look at the attitudes of the culture as a whole, and you see that Marx and Darwin, although they may be racist, are diverging from the accepted standards. Freud may reflect the accepted standards in scientific research, and you analyze it that way.
Have you examined the ideology of Marx and Darwin, and in what way it relates to their historical situation? I mean, to get away from the mistake made about Freud, which is such an old one and really rather pointless than it is about Vienna at that particular time. I mean, obviously, Marx and Darwin have some connection with the historical context. I know that she placed a great deal of emphasis on personal characters, especially on Darwin. But what about the way in which they represented 19th century society ideologically in their work without knowing it?
There has been a number of arguments put forth that Darwin reflected the ideology of the 19th century. In my own field of anthropology, Marvin Harris, in the book The Rise of Anthropological Theory, gets into this. He claims that Darwin derived his view of evolution from the prevailing ideological climate of the times. And before I started on this work, I subscribed to that view, and it's since changed. I think that somehow Darwin managed to get outside of that, and if his views were antithetical to certain ideological principles, I still think he would have put them forth. It just happens that there's a coincidence here.
What do you mean by the ideology of the 19th century? I mean, what about Marx? You were being asked by Rowley whether Marx was an imperialist or not. That's one way of interpreting what Rowley was saying.
Well, at times Marx was an imperialist. At times he wasn't. He changed.
Well,
to suit certain situations.
Let's get down to Darwin.
Particularly on the Irish question.
And Mother Nature. Darwin's attitude to Mother Nature. I'm not sure if I can quote the passage correctly, but it's somewhat the effect that nature looks for the good of every being that she tends. And then there's another passage, which I can't remember precisely, that talks about perfection. Now, what do you see as the ideological implications of those statements, and how would you relate them to Marx's attitudes?
That comes, I think, at the end of The Origin of Species. He begins to get a little bit into a kind of literary prose where he talks about perfection and the creator and things that imply a kind of teleology which isn't in the work at all.
What do you mean, you said it's not in the work?
When you study carefully, you find that, as Marx said, Darwin dealt a death blow to teleology, but if you read the last three pages of The Origin of Species, it doesn't sound like that. It sounds like Darwin affirms
it. Nobody dealt a death blow, but the environmentalists are still playing with teleological perceptions. They just don't know they're doing it. I think Marx is wrong. Marx is a teleologist too, in certain respects.
But his method can be taken apart from his teleology or his prophecy.
I'm talking about prophecy. I'm talking about a specific ideology in our society which has to do with movement towards an end. I'm talking about the great change of being, and how he's turned around as an ideology of perfection in the 18th century. What that has to do with progress, with the ideology of progress and with the invention of the idea of progress. And that's really the question directed to. How do Marx and Darwin relate to the invention of the idea of progress, which is, what, about 300 years old?
Yeah, okay, there is no doubt about it. Marx believed in the concept of progress. He is part and parcel of this tradition. It cannot be denied. Darwin is somewhat different. There are lapses in his writing where one would be led to assume that he thought things were progressing, so to speak. But there are other aspects of his writings that are completely antithetical to this, where he states that progress is not an inevitable law of nature, that we can't use these assumptions in looking at nature. So he has it both ways. Marx, I would say, is a progressivist coming out of the Enlightenment tradition, sure. Darwin, it seems to shift back and forth when it suits his convenience or his writing style. But the modern biologists, by and large, aren't in that tradition, and they derive their views from the aspect of Darwin which was not progressivist.
Okay, there's one other question I'd like to ask, which is, you said a number of times that socialist natural, which is understandable in the 19th century context that you're talking about. What do you view as the primary difference between nature and culture or nature and society? How would you, if you had to draw a boundary, how would you draw it between nature?